The next topic that Jung asked me to address is the work of Bart Ehrman, who is the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and the best-selling author with Oxford University Press in their retinue of various authors. Ehrman is an interesting person. I had a debate with him several years ago at Holy Cross College, and discovered in reading his autobiography that he and I have a remarkably similar background. We both came to Christ as teenage boys who were somewhat marginalized and had a passing acquaintance with the Christian faith, but whose lives were turned upside down by receiving Jesus Christ as our personal Savior when we were around 15 or 16 years of age. Eager to serve the Lord, we both attended then the same college in Illinois, Wheaton College in the Chicago suburbs. We even took Greek under the same professor, Gerald Hawthorne. After graduation, we both went on to pursue doctoral studies. But then our paths radically diverged. I received a fellowship from the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation to study the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus under the direction of Wolfhard Pannenberg at the University of Munich and Cambridge University. And as a result of my studies, I became even more convinced of the historical credibility of Jesus' resurrection. Now, of course, ever since my conversion, I believed that God had raised Jesus from the dead. And I still think that this purely experiential approach to a knowledge of the resurrection is perfectly legitimate. But as a result of my studies, I came to find that there was a remarkably good historical case that can be made for Jesus' resurrection as well, so that I was even more confirmed in my Christian faith as a result of my graduate studies. Sadly, Dr. Ehrman came to radically different conclusions as a result of his studies at Princeton University. He poignantly describes how he came to doubt the doctrine of biblical inerrancy as a result of his studies, and how this finally led him to abandon faith in Christ. Eventually, he became an agnostic, finally an atheist, and to now today he is an apostate Christian to all appearances, and writes books against the Christian faith, which are enormously destructive and which have proved very troubling to many Christians who read them, and as a result are filled with doubts about their own Christian faith and experience. And so Jung invited me to share some thoughts about Bart Ehrman's objections to Christianity, which I'm eager to do with you this morning. First, I want to just say a brief word about Ehrman's work on textual criticism of the New Testament. Bart Ehrman's area of expertise is the text, the original Greek text of the New Testament. He is a textual critic. Although he likes to posture himself in his books as a historian, an expert or scholar in life of Jesus research, in fact, that is not his area of specialization or training. He is a textual critic who is someone who works with manuscripts to establish the original text of the autographs or the original writings of the New Testament. He studied with Bruce Metzger, the great textual critic at Princeton University, and took over from Metzger editing the Greek text of the New Testament. Unfortunately, Bart Ehrman has used his prestige as a text critic to give the impression to lay people that the text of the New Testament is terribly corrupted and uncertain. He wrote a book called Misquoting Jesus, in which he gives the impression to lay people that we really don't know what the original New Testament said because, as it's been copied over the years, so many thousands and thousands of thousands of variants have crept into the manuscripts that it's just uncertain what the original text read. Now, here, what has happened, I think, is there are really two Bart Ehrmans that are on display. Dan Wallace, who is a textual scholar at Dallas Theological Seminary, likes to distinguish between what he calls the scholarly Bart Ehrman and the popular Bart Ehrman. The scholarly Bart Ehrman knows that the text of the New Testament has been established to 99% accuracy. That is to say, the original wording of the New Testament is now established to about 99%, so that the degree of uncertainty in the text of the New Testament is only about 1%. There are about 138,000 Greek words in the New Testament. Of these, only about 1,400 are uncertain today. 99% are established with real certainty. And of that 1% that still remains uncertain, virtually certain, Bad Bart deliberately misrepresents the situation to lay audiences, to make them think that the New Testament is incredibly corrupted and uncertain. And it's very interesting that when the Bad Bart is pressed on this issue by someone, he'll come clean and admit this. For example, I heard Bart Ehrman interviewed on a radio show some time ago about misquoting Jesus, and the interviewer was talking to him about how uncertain the text of the New Testament, all the thousands and thousands of variants that there are, and how uncertain it is. And finally, the interviewer said to him, "Well, Dr. Ehrman, what do you think the text of the New Testament originally really said?" And Ehrman replied, "Well, I don't understand what you mean. What are you talking about?" And the interviewer said, "Well, the text of the New Testament, it's been so corrupted as it's been copied. What do you think the original text actually said?" And Ehrman said, "Well, it says pretty much what we have today, what it says now." And the interviewer was utterly confused. He said, "Well, I thought it was all corrupted." He says, "Well, we've been able to reestablish the text of the New Testament as textual scholars." So that he knows, and when pressed, admits that the text in the New Testament is 99% established. Now, let me just be very clear about this. That doesn't prove that the text is true. This doesn't prove that the text is historically accurate. It's just to say that we know what 99% of the original wording of these documents was. So, do you see, that's not the same as saying that it's established with historical accuracy. Sometimes Christians make this mistake. It's just to say that we now know what 99% of the original words in the New Testament were, and that that 1% that's still somewhat uncertain are just utter trivialities on which nothing hangs. So, don't be troubled when you hear the Bad Bart talking about the corruptions and the variants in the copies of the New Testament. The bottom line is that the text of the New Testament has now been established to about 99%. Now, that leads to the second point that I wanted to talk about, and that is Bart Ehrman's work on the historical Jesus. Now, I want to talk, first of all, about what are called the criteria of authenticity. This is absolutely crucial because in order to establish what is historically provable about Jesus of Nazareth, you need to have certain criteria that will tell you what can be established historically about Jesus. These criteria are crucial in historical study, and therefore it's vitally important to state the criteria accurately and precisely. If you don't get the criteria right, the conclusions you draw are going to be wrong. And therefore, it's very important to state the criteria accurately and precisely. And I must say, I was very surprised when I read Dr. Ehrman's writings on the historical Jesus and found the sloppiness with which he states and applies these criteria. In every single case, Dr. Ehrman misformulates the criterion And then he goes on to misapply it. And there is example after example after example of this, which I will give. And this is a consistent pattern in the way Bart Ehrman deals with the historical Jesus. First, he misstates the criterion, then he misapplies it. Now, this is important because when I formulate my case for the resurrection of Jesus, I do so with these criteria deliberately in mind. When I give those four facts on which the inference to the resurrection of Jesus is based, namely the honorable burial of Jesus in the tomb, the discovery of his empty tomb, the postmortem appearances of Jesus, and the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection, all and every one of these four facts is established by the very criteria that Bart Ehrman states and endorses. And so even using his own criteria, there's no basis for being skeptical about these fundamental facts with respect to Jesus' resurrection. Now let's look in more detail at the criteria of authenticity as Bart Ehrman states them. The first criterion is independent attestation. Do we have that? Okay, here is how he states the criterion of independent attestation. Quote, an event mentioned in several independent documents is more likely to be historically accurate than an event mentioned in only one. And this comes from his lectures on the historical Jesus with the teaching company. That's what TC stands for with the page number in his teaching company lectures on the historical Jesus. Now, what's the problem with this formulation of the criterion of independent attestation? Well, notice that it makes the criterion a comparative measure between two different events. It says an event mentioned in several independent documents is more likely to be historically accurate than some other event mentioned in only one. Now, as such, by making it a comparison between two different events, it's obviously false, because the singly attested event could pass other criteria which make it as likely or even more likely than the multiply attested event. The event which is found in only one source might pass other criteria, like the criterion of embarrassment or the criterion of dissimilarity, and then be highly historically probable, even though it's only singly attested rather than multiply attested. So Ehrman has simply misformulated the criterion of independent attestation. Here's the correct formulation. An event mentioned in several independent documents is more likely to be historical than it would have been had it been mentioned in only one. An event mentioned in several independent documents is more likely to be historical than it would have been had it been mentioned in only one. Or, more simply, independent attestation increases the probability that an event is historical. So if an event in the life of Jesus is attested in independent sources, then it's more probable that that's historical, because it's unlikely to have been independently made up by two different sources. This is one of the most important criteria that historians use in assessing historicity of events, whether it's independently attested. Second criterion is the criterion of dissimilarity. Here's how Ehrman states the criterion. Any tradition about Jesus that does not coincide with or that works against the vested interests of the Christians who preserved it is likely to be historically reliable. Any tradition about Jesus that does not coincide with or works against the vested interests of the Christians who preserved it is likely to be historically reliable. Well, what's the problem with this statement of the criterion of dissimilarity? Well, twofold. Number one, it conflates and distorts two distinct criteria, namely the criterion of dissimilarity and the criterion of embarrassment. It conflates these two and distorts them. Here's what the correct statement of the criterion of dissimilarity should be. If a tradition about Jesus is different from the Judaism that preceded him and the Christian movement which came after him, then it's likely to be historically reliable. If a tradition about Jesus is different from the Judaism that preceded him and the Christian movement that followed him, then it's likely to be historically reliable. And the idea there is that if it's not from antecedent Judaism, then likely it didn't come from there. If it's unlike the later Christian church, then it was unlikely to have been made up by them, so it probably originated with the historical Jesus himself. That's the criterion of dissimilarity. Here's the criterion of embarrassment. If a tradition about Jesus is embarrassing or awkward for the early Christian movement, then it's likely to be historically reliable. If a tradition about Jesus is embarrassing or awkward for the early Christian movement, then it's likely to be historically reliable because it's unlikely the early Christian movement would make up or invent stories about Jesus that would be awkward or embarrassing for the Christian faith. Now, Ehrman's statement not only blurs these two criteria together, but notice that it leaves wholly out of account Jesus' distinctiveness from Judaism. He fails to mention that if something is dissimilar from antecedent Judaism, that increases its historical probability. Now, Ehrman, that's the first problem, is that it conflates and distorts these two separate criteria. Here's the second problem with his statement of the criterion of dissimilarity. He consistently confuses this criterion with the problem of bias in one's sources, and that's just not the same thing. Dissimilarity and embarrassment are positive criteria for establishing historicity. If something is dissimilar or embarrassing, that's a positive argument in favor of historicity. But Ehrman uses them negatively to undermine historical credibility. And this negative use of the criteria is widely recognized as fallacious, because it would yield a Jesus who had absolutely no impact on the movement which followed him and who was utterly unlike antecedent Judaism which preceded him. So it would give you a bizarre Jesus, a Jesus who was utterly unlike Judaism and who had no impact on the Christianity which followed him. So a negative use of the criteria is illegitimate. They can only be used to establish positively historical traditions about Jesus, not to call into question historical traditions about Jesus. In other words, if something is not dissimilar or not embarrassing, that's not a proof that it's unhistorical. If something is dissimilar or embarrassing, that counts in favor of historicity. That's the positive use of the criteria. But if something is not dissimilar or not embarrassing, that's no proof that it's not historical. Criterion number three, contextual credibility. Here he says, any tradition about Jesus that cannot be plausibly situated in first century Palestinian context cannot be accepted as historically reliable. Any tradition about Jesus that cannot be plausibly situated in first century Palestinian context cannot be accepted as historically reliable. Well, that's just a truism. And the problem with that truism is that it's purely negative, and so it doesn't establish what is historical about Jesus. It would just exclude something that would be unhistorical, but it doesn't establish anything positively about Jesus. The correct formulation of the criterion of contextual credibility would be traditions about Jesus which cohere well with already established facts about Jesus have a good probability of being historically reliable. Traditions about Jesus which cohere well with already established facts about Jesus have a good probability of being historically reliable. So, correctly understood then, we have four criteria for establishing traditions about Jesus: independent attestation, dissimilarity, embarrassment, and contextual credibility. Now, let me show next Bart Ehrman's misuse of the criteria of authenticity. First, his use of the criteria results in a distortion of the historical Jesus. A real historical person is a much richer reality than what can be proved about a person. Think of Napoleon, for example. The historical Napoleon is a much, much richer figure than what we can prove about Napoleon, right? What you can prove about Napoleon is a small subset of the man who actually lived. We don't know a lot of things about his private life or what he was doing that wasn't recorded by historians. But Ehrman equates, quote, a strictly historical perspective with what we can show on historical grounds. He equates the historical Jesus with what you can prove about Jesus. And that leads to a reconstructed Jesus, which is a pale abstraction of the robust reality that actually lived. The historical Jesus who actually lived is a much richer reality than what we can prove about Jesus. They're not the same thing. Now, the next major point I want to make is that the criteria, when properly used, show the reliability of traditions about Jesus, but Ehrman tries to use them negatively to show unreliability. He misuses the criteria. The criteria can be properly used only to establish positively historical elements about Jesus, but Ehrman uses them negatively to try to show unreliability. For example, he says, and I quote, "Some of the best known traditions of Jesus' birth cannot be accepted as historically reliable when gauged by our criteria." Some of the best known traditions of Jesus' birth cannot be accepted as historically reliable when gauged by our criteria. Notice that's a negative use of the criteria. But the criteria can't be used negatively to establish non-historicity. They can only be used positively to establish historicity. So it's impossible, when they're used properly, to say that these birth narratives are shown to be unhistorical in nature. What he should say is that some of the best-known traditions of Jesus' birth cannot be positively proven to be historical by these criteria. And that's unobjectionable. There can be lots of things about Jesus that we cannot prove using these criteria that are nevertheless recorded in the gospel. So you see how he slides from saying these birth traditions cannot be proven to be historical by the criterion, to saying that therefore they cannot be accepted as historically reliable on the basis of these criteria. Or here's another example. We don't have any reliable information concerning what Mary actually thought of Jesus because the traditions are not multiply attested and don't pass the criterion of dissimilarity. See the negative use of the criteria there? Because they're not multiply attested, because they're not dissimilar, therefore, he says, none of this information is reliable that we have in the Gospels. You can't use the criteria negatively in that way. At best, the criteria could be used to establish positively reliable information about what Mary thought. But if the traditions are only singly attested or not dissimilar, then all you can say is, we can't prove these to be reliable. But that doesn't prove that they're unreliable. So this is just one illustration of this constant use or misuse by Bart Ehrman of the criteria in an illegitimate negative way. Now let's look more specifically at some of the specific criteria. First, the criterion of independent attestation. Let me give you some examples of his misuse of this criterion. He gives a study question, number one, to his students. Pick two events, one provable, one not, by independent attestation. What is the difference in the evidence? Notice this is a misuse of the criterion because it's comparing two events rather than one event. The criterion only applies to one event, not to two. And so it's a misuse of the criterion. Another example, he says, he admits that the virgin birth passes the criterion of independent attestation. It's found in both Matthew and in Luke's gospel, and these are independent of each other. So the virgin birth passes the criterion of independent attestation. But Ehrman complains, well, it's not more widely attested, and therefore he denies its historicity. Well, that's misusing the criterion again. It is independently attested. That counts in favor of its historicity. And in any case, you can't use it negatively to deny historicity. Or again, the birth in Bethlehem passes the criterion of independent attestation. We have independent accounts in Matthew and Luke that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. But again, Ehrman complains about a lack of more sources and says there are secondary inconsistencies in the narrative, and therefore we can't know Jesus was born in Bethlehem, which is simply a failure to apply consistently the criterion of independent attestation. Another example, he argues against the historicity of the trip to Bethlehem by Joseph and Mary because it's not multiply attested. That's an illegitimate use of the criterion. Just because it's not multiply attested, you can't infer that it's unhistorical. Or finally, he rejects Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem despite the fact that it is multiply and independently attested in Mark's gospel and in John's gospel. Why? Well, he rejects it because it's not dissimilar. But that's denying both the criterion of independent attestation and misusing dissimilarity in a negative way. So these are just some examples of his misuse of the criterion of independent attestation. What about the criterion of dissimilarity? Well, here are some illustrations of his misuse of this criterion. He says, some traditions may strike us as suspect in view of the criterion. That's impossible because the criterion can only be used positively to show that something is likely to be historical because it is dissimilar. If it's not dissimilar, that gives no reason to think it's suspect. Or another example, he says it casts a shadow of doubt on certain traditions in the Gospel of Thomas. Again, that's using the criterion negatively. You cannot use the criterion to cast doubt on certain traditions, only to establish them. Another example, he says, sources for the virgin birth have a vested interest in the doctrine, and so it doesn't pass the criterion. Well, this confuses dissimilarity with vested interest. Just because they have a vested interest in believing in the virgin birth doesn't mean that the story of the virgin birth isn't dissimilar. In fact, the story of the virgin birth is radically dissimilar to antecedent Judaism and paganism. Contrary to what you hear on the internet, the fact is that there are no parallels to the virgin birth in pagan religions in the ancient Near East. The stories of divine human offspring of a god and a human female in ancient mythology were not virgin birth stories. They were stories of the God coming down from heaven and physically having sexual intercourse with a human woman and impregnating her so that she bears a child that is then a divine human being like Hercules. But there's nothing in pagan mythology or antecedent Judaism that is similar to the virgin birth story of Jesus, which is emphatically not a story of a God coming down from heaven in human form and copulating with a human female. So it is dissimilar, in fact, as well as multiply attested. He says the story of the wise men doesn't pass the criterion of dissimilarity because it has theological purposes. But again, failure to pass the criterion doesn't show that it's unhistorical. That's just a confusion. He denies Jesus' passion predictions because they're not dissimilar. That, again, is a misuse of the criterion. Just because something is not dissimilar doesn't mean it's unhistorical. He denies the crowds calling for Jesus' crucifixion because that's not dissimilar. But again, that's to use the criterion negatively rather than positively. Finally, he denies the 30 pieces of silver for which Judas betrayed Jesus because it's not dissimilar. But once again, you can't judge a narrative to be unhistorical because it's not dissimilar. So I think you can see over and over and over again, he misuses the criteria of authenticity. Finally, what about the criterion of contextual credibility? Remember I said that this criterion properly stated can be used to establish historicity by showing its context. Now here Ehrman, I think, actually uses the criterion properly, but it's contrary to his misstatement of it. His misstatement was, remember, a negative misstatement that you use it to exclude historicity, and yet he argues Jesus spoke Aramaic because it makes sense contextually. He argues Jesus was an apocalypticist because of contextual credibility. He argues that the title, the Son of Man, is an authentic expression used by Jesus because it is contextually credible. And he argues that Jesus was an exorcist because that's contextually credible. Those are all proper use of the criterion, positive arguments on the basis of the criterion. But you remember, that wasn't the way he stated the criterion. He stated the criterion negatively to say that if something wasn't contextually credible, then it was unhistorical. So here, ironically, he winds up using the criterion correctly, positively, because he abandons his own misstatement of it. So I think you can see that when you look at Ehrman's statement of and use of the criteria, this is really a disaster. It's really an embarrassment that a New Testament scholar should be this sloppy. Now let's look specifically at Jesus' claim to be the Son of Man. And we saw that Ehrman does agree that Jesus used the title the Son of Man as a self-designation. And this is extremely important because by using the title the Son of Man, Jesus is alluding to that divine human figure prophesied by Daniel, to whom God would give all authority and judgment over all the kingdoms of the earth, that all the peoples of the earth should worship and serve him. So Jesus' claim to be the Son of Man is dynamite theologically because it shows Jesus' divine human self-consciousness and understanding. How does Ehrman regard the title Son of Man? He thinks Jesus did claim to be, or rather he didn't, he believed Jesus did use the title the Son of Man. But he didn't think Jesus claimed to be the Son of Man because he thought Jesus was referring to somebody else. So that when he predicted the Son of Man will come and do this or that, he was talking about another person. Now this is a bizarre interpretation of the title, which was held by Rudolf Bultmann back in the mid-20th century and which was influential at that time in Germany. But it's no longer a widely held view. I asked several of my New Testament colleagues about this. Can you think of anybody who thinks that Jesus used the title the Son of Man to refer to somebody else other than himself? They couldn't even think of any other contemporary scholar that holds to this view. Well, why not? Why are so few persuaded by this Bultmannian view? Well, first of all, there's no good evidence for this interpretation. Ehrman's only proof of this interpretation is Jesus saying in Mark 8:38, "Whoever is ashamed of me, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him." Whoever is ashamed of me, Jesus, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him. And Ehrman says we could take this to mean that if you're ashamed of Jesus, then the Son of Man, whoever he is, will also be ashamed of you, somebody other than Jesus. Well, yeah, you could take it that way, but there's no reason that you should. In fact, that seems an extremely contrived interpretation. And that leads me to my second point. There are good reasons to reject this interpretation. First of all, first point, over and over again in the Gospels, Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. This is Jesus' favorite self-designation in the gospel. Some 80 times he refers to himself as the Son of Man. Dr. Ehrman's view would require that all of these statements of self-reference by Jesus are inauthentic, that these are creations of the early Christian church. But here he faces a huge problem. The title, the Son of Man, appears only once in the New Testament outside the Gospels. One time in the book of Acts, it's applied to Jesus. Now, what that shows is that this title was not a title that was widely used in the New Testament church for Jesus. So, by the strictest use of the criterion of dissimilarity, it must belong to the historical Jesus. This was evidently a title that Jesus used of himself, but which didn't catch on in the early church and soon dropped out of use. So, by the criterion of dissimilarity, we have very powerful grounds for thinking Jesus used this title as a self-designation. Number two, there are authentic Son of Man sayings which clearly refer to Jesus. There are specific Son of Man sayings that clearly refer to Jesus. Let me mention three of them. Number one, Jesus saying in Matthew 8:20, "Foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Now, obviously, the Son of Man in this saying is not referring to some future coming cosmic king. And incredibly, Dr. Ehrman himself, on page 31 of part 2 of his lectures on the historical Jesus, agrees that this is an authentic saying of the historical Jesus. So clearly, Jesus did think of himself as the Son of Man, and Ehrman admits this saying is authentic. Second example, Matthew chapter 19 and verse 25. Jesus tells his disciples, "In the renewed world, you shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Now, Dr. Ehrman himself accepts this as a historically authentic saying of the historical Jesus. But this raises a very interesting question. If the disciples will sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel, who's going to be the king over all of Israel? Well, Dr. Ehrman answers unhesitatingly, Jesus, Jesus himself. He says, and I quote, "The earliest traditions indicate that Jesus thought he would be enthroned. Jesus would rule over the disciples." So Jesus will be the king of Israel over the disciples who are on the 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. But look at what the full text of Matthew 19:28 says. "In the renewed world, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you shall also sit upon the 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." This is a Son of Man saying in which Jesus is calling himself the Son of Man who will be the King of Israel. So Ehrman himself is committed to saying in this saying Jesus uses it as a self-designation. Third example, in Jesus' trial scene before the high priest, Dr. Ehrman cannot make sense out of Jesus' condemnation by the Sanhedrin. You remember at the trial, the high priest asks Jesus, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus responds, "I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And the high priest rips his garment and says, "Blasphemy." And the council all unanimously votes to condemn Jesus to death as a blasphemer. Now, since Dr. Ehrman takes Jesus to be referring to somebody else when he says, "You will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven," etc., He can't make any sense of why the Sanhedrin condemns Jesus for blasphemy. He writes, "It is difficult to understand the trial because the charge of blasphemy cannot be rooted in anything Jesus said. It wasn't blasphemous to call oneself the Messiah, nor to say that the Son of Man was soon to arrive. Yet the high priest accused Jesus of blasphemy." So Dr. Ehrman's view cannot make sense of Jesus' death, which violates one of the basic criteria of authenticity, namely that you got to have a view that coheres with what is firmly established about Jesus, like his crucifixion. By contrast, if Jesus did identify himself as the Son of Man, then everything falls into place. And Dr. Ehrman admits this. He says, "One could conceive of his statement as blasphemous only by assuming that Jesus was the Son of Man, because then Jesus would be saying that he had a standing equal with God." Right, right. So, again, there are specific Son of Man sayings that show very clearly that Jesus wasn't talking about somebody else, he was talking about himself. That's my second point. My third point, by way of criticism, is that Dr. Ehrman's view cannot make sense of Jesus' claim to ultimate authority. There's something of a consensus among New Testament scholars that Jesus of Nazareth came on the scene with an unsurpassed sense of authority. Ehrman himself recognizes that Jesus thought that people's fate ultimately hinged upon their response to him, and that he thought they would be judged before the Son of Man on the basis of their response to Jesus, and that Jesus thought that he would be the king in the kingdom of God. He put himself in God's place by his words and actions. But then, you see, it makes no sense at all to think that Jesus thought that somebody else was going to come who would judge the world and who would presumably judge Jesus himself, someone to whom Jesus would be submitted as if he were merely human prophet. Jesus' unsurpassed sense of divine authority is incompatible with the view that he thought somebody else was the coming Son of Man who would judge the mankind and Jesus himself. So, in summary then, I think it's very clear that there are good reasons to reject Ehrman's interpretation that although Jesus used the expression Son of Man, he wasn't talking about himself, but about somebody else. Finally, the last point that I want to make in my critique of Ehrman is to say something about his views on the resurrection of Jesus. Although Dr. Ehrman says that there cannot be any historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, what he really means, I think, is that the resurrection cannot be the best explanation of the evidence. Not that there is no evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And let me see if I've got this on the PowerPoint for my... Yes, there's two basic contentions or moves in constructing a case for the resurrection. First, that there are four historical facts which must be explained by any historical hypothesis: the burial, the empty tomb, the postmortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. Second, then, is to show that the best explanation of these facts is that Jesus rose from the dead. And although Ehrman says there's no evidence for the resurrection, in fact, he doesn't dispute point one. What he really means is point two, is that the best explanation of the evidence cannot be the resurrection. Let's go to the next slide, please. Ah, this is a part about the problem of miracles. Okay, I don't think we're going to have time to go through all of this because of our time constraints. So let me just skip ahead. And I simply want to make this point. With respect to that first major point, if we can go back a couple of slides. Yes, to this one. Ehrman actually agrees with all four of those facts that I mentioned. And again, here's the difference between the good Bart and the bad Bart. The good Bart, in his scholarly lectures, admits all four of these facts. The bad Bart, in his public debates, tries to cast doubt upon these by saying, oh, the narratives are filled with contradictions and uncertainties, the number of angels at the tomb, the names of the women that went to the tomb, whether they went when the sun was risen, whether they went when it was still dark. What did they do after they saw the angel? Did they go tell the disciples? Did they tell no one? And he gives the impression to lay people that the narratives are so hopelessly contradictory that they cannot be believed in their historical core. And I lost all respect for Bart Ehrman, frankly, when I saw in public debate how he deliberately and deceptively tries to mislead laymen about this. Because in his scholarly work, the good Bart knows that despite these inconsistencies and contradictions, nevertheless, the core facts that I have listed are credibly established. Here's what Bart Ehrman says in his lectures on the historical Jesus with the Teaching Company. He says, there are a couple of things that we can say for certain about Jesus after his death. We can say with relative certainty, for example, that he was buried. The accounts are fairly unanimous in saying, the earliest accounts we have are unanimous in saying, that Jesus was in fact buried by this fellow Joseph of Arimathea. And so it's relatively reliable that that's what happened. We also have solid traditions to indicate that women found this tomb empty 3 days later. This is attested in all of our gospel sources, early and late, and so it appears to be a historical datum. And so I think we can say that after Jesus' death, with some certainty that he was buried, possibly by this fellow Joseph of Arimathea, and that 3 days later he appeared not to have been in the tomb. He also acknowledges the earliest disciples saw appearances of Jesus and that they came to believe that Jesus was risen from the dead. So the good part recognizes that even given all the inconsistencies and contradictions in the narrative, the four fundamental facts remain firmly historically established. So, what Ehrman's real problem with the resurrection is in saying the resurrection cannot be the best explanation. Well, why not? Well, the reason is because the resurrection is a miraculous explanation, and he says historians cannot adopt a miraculous explanation as the best explanation. Now, how can I handle this best here? Let's go to the slide that is called Ehrman's Egregious Error. Can you go to that one? Ehrman's Egregious Error. Okay, here's Ehrman's Egregious Error. This is the quotation here. Because historians can only establish what probably happened, and a miracle of this nature is highly improbable, the historian cannot say it probably occurred. Now, to the layperson, that sounds really plausible, doesn't it? Because historians can only establish what probably happened, and a miracle of this nature is highly improbable, the historian cannot say it probably occurred. This is just David Hume's old argument against the identification of miracles warmed over. And the fallacy is this, that the only factor he considers in assessing the probability of the resurrection hypothesis is in red, the probability of the resurrection on our background information, B. He's saying a miracle is inherently improbable because relative to our background information of the world, dead men do not rise from the dead. And so that makes the resurrection hypothesis intrinsically improbable. But what he fails to understand is that the probability calculus for accounting for the resurrection hypothesis is not just the probability of the resurrection on the background information, but also the probability of the resurrection on the background information and the evidence E. And the evidence E will be things like the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. And so what Ehrman concludes is that because the probability of R on B is low, therefore the probability of R on B and E is low. And that's just mathematically, demonstrably fallacious. It only considers one factor in the probability calculus. You also have to figure, what is the probability of the evidence given the background information and the resurrection? And what is the probability of Jesus not rising from the dead on the background information? And the probability of the evidence of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' faith, given our background information and the fact that Jesus did not rise from the dead. And the bottom line is that when you compute all those other factors, it is perfectly plausible and possible for the probability of the resurrection on the background information and the evidence to be very high, even though the probability of R on B is very low. The probability of the resurrection on the background information and the evidence can be very high, even though the probability of the resurrection on the background information alone is very low. And that is Ehrman's egregious error, as I've called it, is thinking that because the probability of R on B is low, therefore the probability of the resurrection is low. And that just is a fallacious inference. Let me go to the slide, Bart's blunder. Bart's blunder. Here's an even more egregious error. And he repeats these errors over and over again in his writings. It's just shocking. Okay, Bart's blunder. Since historians can establish only what probably happened in the past, they cannot show that miracles happened, since this would involve a contradiction. Namely, the most improbable event is the most probable. So it would be a contradiction to show the resurrection happened, because that would be to show that the most improbable event is the most probable event. In fact, there's no contradiction at all, because you're talking about two different probabilities. One would be the probability of the resurrection on the background information, which would be perhaps very low. The other probability is the probability of the resurrection on the background information and the evidence, and that probability could be very high. So there's no contradiction at all in saying that an intrinsically improbable event is the most probable event given the evidence. There's just no contradiction at all. So it's an enormous blunder on Ehrman's part. It shows that he simply doesn't understand probability theory or how to compute the probability of the resurrection hypothesis. One final point that I want to make. Let's go back to Ehrman's egregious error. You remember we saw that he assumes that the probability of the resurrection on the background information is very low. He just assumes that. But how does he know that? Why is the hypothesis God raised Jesus from the dead highly improbable on our background information? Whether this is very low or not will depend on whether or not the background information includes the existence of God. Now, if the background information includes, as I think, the cosmological argument, the teleological argument, the moral argument, the ontological argument, then I don't see any reason to think that the probability of the resurrection on that background information is terribly low, because the background information includes the fact that God exists. So what is the probability that God would raise Jesus from the dead relative to our background information, which includes that God exists and all of our information about the historical Jesus, including his radical personal claims to be the Son of Man and the divine revelation of God? Well, I can't see any reason to think that that's highly improbable. So what I would agree with Ehrman, what's highly improbable is that Jesus rose naturally from the dead. That is highly improbable. Corpses don't just come back to life. It's highly improbable that Jesus rose naturally from the dead, given our background information. But given our background information, especially if that includes the existence of God and Jesus' radical personal claims, I just can't see any reason to think that the probability of R on B is very low. And if that's right, then it just completely evacuates his argument of any significance, because then the probability of R on B is not unacceptably low. And therefore, the probability of the resurrection on the background information and the evidence can be very high indeed. Well, there's a lot more that I could say about this. The transcript of my debate with Bart Ehrman is available on our website, reasonablefaith.org. And you can read yourself how Bart Ehrman responds to my charges that he has committed an egregious error and an enormous blunder, and see whether or not you think he has a convincing response. I don't think that he does. And therefore, I don't think that he has good grounds for denying that Jesus of Nazareth was who he claimed to be, and that God raised him from the dead in vindication of those radical claims. All right, do we have time for any questions? Okay.
We have time for a couple questions.
Yeah, I was wondering if I could get your opinion on this. It stems from the fact that many objections to Christianity come from the basis that God is all-knowing, that he exists across all time, and that he's all-powerful. I know that you respond to many of these claims using Molinism, which I think that you've developed pretty well. But what I thought, I'm not even sure if this is correct or not, I kind of want to get your opinion on this, is that if you were to take those concepts of God being all-powerful and existing all across all time and map them onto mathematics, you get infinities. And if you were to, if you try to draw, make an analysis off of those, to put them together, to, you know, do operations on those, that's not really mathematically possible. You learn in calculus that you use the Hopital's rule when you've got a couple of infinities together.
Okay, so I'm not sure I'm following the question. Are you saying that in virtue of being omnipotent, that would imply the existence of a sort of actual infinity? Is that the problem?
Yeah, that these sort of imply properties of God that are infinite. For example,
properties of God that are infinite.
Yes.
All right, well, let me respond to this and see what you think. When theologians talk about God's infinity, they're not talking about a mathematical or quantitative concept. They're talking about a qualitative concept. To say that God is infinite is just to say that God is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, necessary, eternal, and so forth. They're not saying that God is a composite of an actually infinite number of definite and discrete parts. So the infinity of God isn't a quantitative concept at all. It's a qualitative notion, and it just means God has these superlative attributes. Indeed, I don't think that really God's infinity is any distinct attribute from all of those others. If you took all of those away, there isn't some attribute left over called infinity. To say God is infinite is just a way, an umbrella term, for saying he's omnipotent, omniscient, morally perfect, eternal, necessary, and so forth. And none of those involve quantitative mathematical concepts. So I don't think that would contradict what I said earlier in the Kalam cosmological argument, that an actually infinite number of things cannot exist.
Okay. To give an example that kind of relates to that, I'm using, for example, the fact that God is outside of time.
Yes.
How is it possible to use that to, like, make an analysis off of that fact, since if you're outside of time, then you really can't do anything, because everything has always existed from outside of time?
Now, okay, I'm not sure, again, I understand you. If God exists outside of time, then it's not true that he has always existed. Always is a temporal concept that implies a duration. If God exists timelessly, temporal categories and words don't even apply to him. So I'm not saying God has existed for infinite time. I'm saying time is finite and had a beginning, and God transcends time. He's just not in the temporal dimension.
Okay.
All right, some other question. Particularly, is there a question on this talk about the historical Jesus, since this was the topic we're on now.
My question is not on this topic, but I was wondering, have you ever experienced doubt in your faith, and if you have any practical advices for us?
Okay, what was the first part of the question?
Have you ever experienced doubts
yeah.
on your faith?
Yeah.
And also, if you have any practical advices for us that are doubting our faith?
Yeah, I have written a chapter in my book, Hard Questions, Real Answers, on the question of doubt. And I think that anybody who believes a particular worldview will have doubts about the truth of that worldview. He'll say, how do I know that this is really true? Am I deluded? Is this really right? This is common, and you shouldn't panic over that. We all question whether or not we believe is true. But I think the secret to victorious Christian living is not allowing unanswered questions to become destructive doubts. We will all have unanswered questions that we will carry to the grave. But that doesn't mean they need to become destructive doubts that paralyze us spiritually and cause us to be impotent in our spiritual lives. So the real key, I think, to victorious Christian living is not to remove all your questions, but to learn to live with unanswered questions. And what I make a number of suggestions in the chapter there, such as understanding the proper relationship between faith and reason. I think that the proper basis for our knowledge of Christianity's truth is not argument and evidence, but the inner witness of the Holy Spirit. And that really underlines the importance of living a Spirit-filled life, of every morning asking God to fill us with His Spirit, to guide us and empower us, to reveal to us sin in our lives, and to constantly confess sin rather than live with unconfessed sin, because it is that that will cause your doubts to grow and to be the most poignant when you're not in proper relationship and fellowship with God. But when the witness of the Spirit is strong and vibrant in your life, then these doubts will become secondary, I think. So that would be a real fundamental thing. Another important factor would be to take opportunity to pursue your doubts into the ground and get answers to them. Take one of those questions that has troubled you and begin to do research on it. If you're a student, make it the topic of an assignment for a class and go after that until you come to intellectual peace with that issue. And I have to say that this is one of the most exhilarating experiences of the spiritual life, to take something that has really troubled you and nagged at you and to pursue it into the ground until you come to a satisfying answer with it. And it gives you such tremendous peace and confidence. In my own life, for example, I was troubled for some years about how God could be eternal and yet also become incarnate in Christ. It seems obvious that there was a time at which the second person of the Trinity did not have a human nature, and there was a time after which the second person of the Trinity did have a human nature. And that therefore it just didn't make sense to say God is timeless and yet enters into human history. And so I struggled with that and eventually had a chance to really pursue that. I spent 13 years studying the relationship between God and time. Wound up writing 6 books on the topic. And came to a view of the understanding between God and time that I find perfectly satisfying, philosophically coherent, and biblically warranted. And the issue is settled for me now. I just don't have any difficulty with that issue at all. And lest you be discouraged by the amount of time I spent investigating that, let me say that I came to the solution long, long before I finished my research. It's just when you're doing philosophical research, you've got to research all the alternatives, all the objections, you know, all of the scholarly literature on the topic so that you can speak authoritatively to it. But the solution that I wanted to propose, I had in mind long before the research and writing was completed. So you can find answers to your questions within a limited amount of time, I think, if you'll pursue them. But beyond that, take a look at the book I also would recommend the work of Gary Habermas on doubt. Gary has written some really good things. And what Habermas shows that I didn't show or realize in my own work on this question is that doubt is really primarily emotional rather than intellectual. Gary has really interesting material on this. He says, for example, your doubts are greater at night than they are during the day. Why? Well, because you're tired, you're stressed out, and so your doubts are worse at night. You know, which shows this isn't rational, this is emotional, and many other factors go to contribute emotionally to doubt. And so Gary talks about ways of really getting a handle on these things emotionally and dealing with this in an effective way. His work on doubt is very good, and I would commend it. Yeah.
Hey, I'm sorry, that's actually it. So, sorry. Let's thank Dr. Craig again for this session.
Thank you.
So, just a couple of announcements. We're going to break for lunch right now. It's 12:25.